Welcome to Managing MDS. I'm Dr. Stephen Gore. In today's presentation, I'll be reviewing monitoring and managing adverse events in older adults with myelodysplastic syndromes. Older adults with MDS have an increased risk for experiencing treatment-emergent adverse events, and ideally, they require tailored monitoring strategies for managing associated toxicities. In this activity, I will cover the major adverse events associated with the currently approved available therapies, as well as toxicities of notable concern in older patients with MDS. I will leave you with strategies to manage adverse events in older patients with significant comorbidities while preventing the discontinuation of therapy and optimizing the benefit of treatment. Let's begin. For any patients with MDS, when one is starting to plan their therapy, it's really critical to establish the goals of treatment. And this is particularly true in the elderly, because depending on what we're trying to accomplish, patients may and physicians may be more or less willing to tolerate certain adverse events. So in order for patients to help partner with a physician in establishing their goals for treatment of their disease, they need to understand their disease, which is by no means easy in this complicated set of diseases that, for the most part, patients are not familiar with. The natural history of their disease. Physician needs to understand what are the patient's hopes and expectations. Is this a robust older patient whose goal is cure, if possible, even if that means some risks of significant toxicities and even treatment-related death? Or is this a patient who really wants best quality of life, wants to palliate their cytopenias? So we really need to know what the patient's goals are. For some patients, all they really care about is getting to their granddaughter's wedding the next year. And after that, whatever happens, happens. And like I said, for other patients who are busy bungee jumping around in the jungles of Brazil, they want their shot at cure, and there's everything in between. So we need to establish whether our approach is going to be palliative or curative. And we need to help patients understand the natural history of their disease. And in order to do this, I usually use one of several prognostic models, which are currently available based on routine clinical data. And the most commonly used one, of course, is the IPSS-R, the revised version of the old IPSS. I would note that many physicians still use the IPSS, and in my opinion, that's no longer adequate, really, because it does not stratify patients clearly enough. There's also the World Health Organization Prognostic Scoring System, or WPSS. The WPSS, which is used far less, has certain advantages because the WPSS was designed to be applied at any time in a patient's treatment course, whereas the IPSS-R theoretically only pertains to the patient at initial diagnosis. However, in my experience, and I usually calculate both the WPSS and the IPSS-R for each patient, I have to use an app for either of them on my phone. Almost to a patient, the two end up being very comparable. So I think either way is really probably okay. And as most of the audience is probably familiar, the IPSS-R divides patients into five risk categories. I personally think that it's important to emphasize the expected survival of a patient rather than the freedom from AML evolution. This concept of AML evolution, I think, is overplayed to patients, because the AML associated with this particular disease is really just worsening MDS. And I think patients, when they're presented with that, all they worry about is, do I have leukemia today? So I deal with this by telling them that MDS is in fact a chronic leukemia. They have leukemia today. And this AML thing is just a name change that we do at 20% blast. So I really emphasize the survival. And I actually do use these survival curves when appropriate, when a patient is robust enough intellectually to be able to show them what can be expected and what the goals, therefore, would be if we were to try to change the natural history for that patient. Now, the IPSS-R is still not the last word because of the explosion in genomics, which has happened over the past several years. And what you see in this particular slide from Matt Walters from Washington University in St. Louis is a landscape of mutations found in a large variety of MDS patients. And the details are not so important, but you can see that the mutations fall into a few categories. One is abnormalities of genes constituting the spliceosome, which is responsible for editing RNA. There's a variety of genes involved in epigenetic modifications, then you can see others as well, transcription factors, signaling. And we know from this slide from Rafa Behar and Ben Ebert that these various gene mutations may have significant prognostic information. So in Rafa and Ben's paper, they looked at the impact of certain mutations on survival impact using just the old-fashioned or original IPSS risk group. And you can see, for example, that if a patient has a TP53 mutation, they are at increased risk of death no matter which IPSS risk group they're in. Similarly, with an EZH2 mutation or an ASXL1 mutation, RUNX1 mutation. Now, how these mutations impact the IPSSR or WPSS is not yet known, the next generation of these prognostic scoring systems will most certainly integrate and incorporate the mutational profiling. However, one thing that I've noted anecdotally is that in the few patients where the WPSS gives me one reading and the IPSSR gives me another reading, interestingly, it's often the WPSS that's the worst prognosis, and it turns out that the patient has one of these bad risk mutations, which I think tips them over. So this is an evolving area, but this is also, I think, part of the emerging routine workup of a patient with MDS. So the goals of therapy need to be best selected to be best suited for an individual. Obviously, we would like to improve overall survival for all patients when possible. We would like to control symptoms. This requires, for most patients, improving their blood counts. Again, this decreasing the risk of progression to AML, I would just say decrease the risk of disease worsening. Again, the cutoff for AML is less significant to me because the body doesn't really know if there's 10% blasts or 15% blasts or 20 or 30% blasts. It's really how the disease impacts the bone marrow function. And at all times, if possible, we would like to improve the quality of life. This is really not trivial because some of the treatments which we offer patients, particularly in the elderly, may acutely at least decrease the quality of life. So it's important to not only focus on survival when we're treating patients. This is an old treatment algorithm that several of us, including Alan List and several others, came up with in about 2004 when azacitidine was being launched commercially. And I think that the overall approach still holds to a great extent. So when one's looking at a patient, we can ask, is this patient now, or will this patient ever be, a candidate for stem cell transplantation? Well, many more patients are eligible now in 2017 than were in 2004. For example, the increasing development of reduced intensity transplantation has made many more patients candidates. The development of alternative donor transplantations, including haploidentical donors, has provided donors for more patients. So just because somebody is a 72-year-old with MDS does not mean a priori that they are not stem cell transplant candidates. And of course, we come back to what are the patient's goals and how robust is the patient, what are the comorbidities, and what are the patient's, you know, wants in life. Once we've determined whether we are going to try to get the patient to stem cell transplant, if that's something the patient wants, we can stratify the patients into higher and lower risk disease categories. And again, this is an old slide, so it falls back on the IPSS, the original IPSS, but we can certainly adopt the IPSSR categories, with the caveat that that intermediate category in the IPSSR or WPSS is one that we're not always so sure what to do with. So looking down the pathways, for lower-risk patients, however we want to stratify them, our therapies may include erythropoietic stimulating agents if the primary problem is anemia, may include immunosuppressive therapies, although in the elderly group, as you'll see, this is something we tend not to apply as much, or we may, in fact, offer DNA methyltransferase inhibitors or azonucleosides, and more about that later. For the specific subset of patients with DEL5Q MDS and lower risk, lenalidomide, of course, is uniquely active. For the higher risk patients, however we want to stratify them or identify them, our only approved drugs are azonucleosides. Of course, some patients will be candidates for induction chemotherapy based on cytarabine. And we would always like to enroll patients on clinical trials whenever possible. So let's talk about erythropoietic stimulating agents for patients with lower risk MDS. And I've summarized a few key points here. ESAs are only effective in patients whose endogenous EPO levels are not terribly high. So as you know, the erythropoietin is made by the juxtaglomerular complex of the kidney in response to the circulating hemoglobin, and somebody with a normal EPO axis who's anemic because of their MDS should be cranking out a lot of EPO. And if their endogenous EPO level is high, we can give erythropoietin or darbepoetin until the cows come home and the patients won't respond. So it's critically important to get a baseline EPO level. And in patients whose EPO level is greater than 500 units per mil, it's pretty much agreed that patients are not likely to respond. As a matter of fact, the closer you look at the data, the response rate probably falls off at about 100. So if the level is less than 200, I'll often consider ESAs. Less than 100, I'm enthusiastic about it. Between 200 and 500, discussion with the patient. The next point is that patients need to receive adequate dosing, and for most patients, that may require more than the so-called standard 40,000 units of erythropoietin a week or comparable dosing schedules of darbepoetin. Most effective papers with that have demonstrated efficacy have used minimal doses of erythropoietin of 60,000 units per week, sometimes higher, and for darbepoetin, 300 micrograms weekly or 500 micrograms every other week. Again, much higher than is used in the other indications. For patients with refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts, in the case of erythropoietin, most patients will not respond unless G-CSF is added to somehow sensitize the cells to the erythropoietin. It's not clear that that's true with darbepoetin, and it's not clear if the erythropoietin dosage is pushed much higher. What is an adequate trial of ESA therapy? Well, in general, patients should receive ESAs, we think, for about 12 weeks. And if you've given 12 weeks of ESAs at a decent dose, they're probably not going to respond if they haven't already. So it's important to know when you're done and stop it. I see a lot of patients who've been on ESAs for years and years and years, and they've been getting transfused every other week, and I just think that's kind of silly. What physicians worry about in use of ESAs in other diseases do not always apply in MDS. For example, patients with MDS are probably not at increased risk of venous thromboembolic disease with ESAs. ESAs are not known to promote disease progression, and we are rarely fortunate enough to have somebody whose hemoglobin overcompensates to where one would need to stop the EPO or darbepoetin because the hemoglobin's gotten too high. That would be a remarkable response. What about immunosuppressive therapy? Well, the best studied immunosuppressive therapy is antithymocyte globulin. And most studies have suggested that, in general, this is not effective in patients greater than age 60, so probably not germane to this discussion in great detail. A possible exception would be patients who have cells with a large granular lymphocytic phenotype or a PNH population. Those patients may respond to immunosuppressive therapy. In the older patients, I'll tend to start with cyclosporin. Again, effects often disappointing. I'll particularly do that in a patient who has an LGL-MDS kind of overlap picture. And of course, cyclosporin may not be well tolerated in the elderly because of renal toxicity. Now, we know that lenalidomide is a highly active drug in lower-risk patients with Del5Q and anemia. So lower-risk MDS patients with Del5Q who are transfusion-dependent have about a two-thirds chance of developing transfusion independence with lenalidomide. There's a recent study from France which looks at the use of lenalidomide in non-Del5Q MDS. So originally, Dr. Raza led a multicenter study looking at the efficacy of lenalidomide in anemic patients with MDS in non-Del5Q and found a 25% response rate, kind of disappointing. This was replicated in the Celgene-sponsored MDS-005 study led by Valeria Santini from Firenze, Italy, which showed exactly the same response rate in a randomized placebo control trial. So the French, as I'll discuss in a minute, looked at lenalidomide in non-Del5Q with or without erythropoietic stimulating agents. We'll talk about that in a minute. The largest risk in all patients, and especially in the elderly, of lenalidomide is the development of cytopenias secondary to treatment, and this is most profound in patients with Del5Q whose platelet count in particular can drop precipitously, as can their neutrophils, and one needs to watch that very, very carefully. But this is true to some extent, a lesser extent, in the non-Del5Q as well. So here's the outline of the French study asking the question, does erythropoietin increase the response to lenalidomide in non-Del5Q? And you can see the inclusion criteria were lower-risk MDS using the old IPSS scoring system, non-Del5Q, transfusion-dependent, and they had to have either failed to respond to an adequate trial of erythropoietic stimulating agent at an adequate dose, as you can see, or relapsed after their ESA response. And such patients were randomly assigned to standard dosing of lenalidomide at 10 milligrams per day for 21 days out of 28, with or without erythropoietin 60,000 units per week. As you can see, and the median age was 72. And here are the outcomes. Looking at the top tranche, in the lenalidomide-only arm, 15 out of 65 patients had an erythroid response. In the lenalidomide plus EPO, it was about double that, 26 patients out of 66, or almost 40%. In multivariate analysis, the addition of erythropoietin was an important factor for response. As you can see again, the endogenous EPO level greater than or less than 100 was also significantly important. And they also looked at the genotype of an important lenalidomide binding factor called cereblon and found a significant impact there. That is not a clinically available test, and that genotyping test I think will need validation. Now, there's been another trial run by Dr. Alan List from Moffitt in the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, which was presented at ASH this year, which had a similar design, although patients couldn't have received erythropoietin before, and shows essentially the same results in a bigger study that's not yet published. Luspatercept is a drug under development, which has a very exciting promise in patients, particularly with anemia and refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts. This is a protein which soaks up SMADs, which include TGF-beta. And these are increased in patients with lower risk MDS, and they seem to inhibit red blood cell growth. So what I'm showing here is an older study presented at the International MDS meeting 2 years ago by Uwe Platzbecker from Germany. This was a phase 2 trial in lower risk patients with MDS who were anemic and who either had an elevated EPO level predictive of non-response to ESAs or who were ESA non-responsive. And here we're only showing 26 patients, 57% of whom had ring sideroblasts. And you can see that there's a 40% erythroid response rate. And the response rate was quite high in patients who had ring sideroblasts or the SF3B1 mutation, which goes along with RARS. So there is a randomized phase 3 placebo-controlled study, which is international and about to wrap up in patients with ring sideroblasts. And we will hear more about this drug coming soon. Let's move on to the treatment of higher-risk patients with azacitidine and decitabine. I mentioned before that azacitidine and decitabine can be used in lower-risk patients with good effect on the hemogram. Whether this is a good long-term strategy or not, I think is beyond the scope of this particular talk. So again, we're supposed to be focusing on toxicity, and I think that the points that I'll make about azacitidine and decitabine in terms of toxicity and adverse events can be extrapolated from the higher risk discussion to lower risk patients whom you may choose to treat with the azanucleosides. The slide that we're showing right now is from the now classic AZA-001 study, which was initiated after the U.S. approval of azacitidine, and which was run by Pharmion Corporation, subsequently Celgene, which bought them out, and which was published in Lancet Oncology by Pierre Fesneau from France. And as I'm sure most of you know, this trial took patients with higher risk MDS, including what used to be called RAEBT, which is now called AML, with myelodysplastic-related features and less than 30% blasts, and randomized patients between a standard dosing schedule of azacitidine versus one of three preselected conventional care regimens, either observation with transfusion support, low-dose cytarabine, or intensive cytarabine-based induction therapy. And this important trial showed an improvement in median survival in the azacitidine treated group. It was really quite remarkable. So we do believe that azanucleosides, particularly azacitidine, which has been shown to improve survival. Unfortunately, none of the current studies of decitabine have demonstrated that. Because we'd like to improve survival, we really need to understand how to mitigate toxicity. I should note also that azacitidine in the setting of lower-risk MDS has not been shown to improve, its impact on survival has not been studied, we should say. So that's why I'm limiting my discussion to higher-risk MDS. So here are the key points. Azanucleosides need to be given in adequate dosing. I think that, particularly in the elderly, many physicians will undertreat patients because they're afraid of the toxicity. But there's a little bit of no pain, no gain here. You have to be willing to tolerate cytopenias and get them through it in order to see the net effect. If you're going to be dose reducing from the get-go, then probably that patient's not really a candidate to get azacitidine nucleosides, at least not under your direction, because they're not likely to get the benefit. They're going to get all the pain out of the gain. One needs to give an adequate number of cycles of drug to know that patients are not responding. And that may require even greater than 6 cycles, but certainly a minimum of 6 cycles to assess hematologic response. I personally don't think that the marrow response by itself has been shown to be meaningful. So many studies will look at marrow CRs in which the marrow is cleared of blasts, but there are still no improvement in the hemogram. And a variety of studies have suggested that such responses are not associated with improved survival. And again, for me, I don't think that it's really worth the toxicity of the drug to continue the azacitidine nucleoside in that setting. That's just my opinion. So management of cytopenia is very important. So while I don't in general give prophylactic antibiotics to patients with MDS, even very neutropenic patients who are not being treated, in most patients who are receiving an azacitidine and we're going to drop their neutrophils further and have gut toxicity potentially, I do. And that will usually include a quinolone for antibacterial prophylaxis and an anti-mold azole. And I usually use voriconazole to prevent mold infections. Of course, one needs to give platelets if patients become critically thrombocytopenic. I usually transfuse for 10,000, even for outpatients if there's no bleeding. Others will choose 20,000. And of course, one needs to mitigate the anemia with red cell transfusions. Appropriate discontinuation, I think, really has to do with in whom do we know that the therapy is benefiting? We'll talk more about that in a minute. And what is the real life experience with the azanucleosides? Is it comparable to the AZA-001 study? So we did a multivariate analysis of patients from the AZA-001 study, and we did a landmark analysis, multivariate analysis, to look at whether ongoing azanucleoside had a benefit to patients whose best response was stable disease. So in the slide that you see before you right now, we took patients whose best response to azacitidine was stable disease at 6 months. We had to compare them to a comparable group in the conventional care regimen. So we needed patients in the conventional care regimens who also had stable disease at 6 months. Now that may be a selected group, we don't know. But in multivariate analysis, when one looks at the people whose best response was stable in AZA versus the be whose best response was stable in the conventional care group, you can see there's absolutely no survival benefit. So to me, if a patient is at best stable after 6 months of AZA, I think one can have a reasonable discussion with them about what is their tolerance to the drug. Is it really worth it to continue the drug when we don't really know that it's improving their survival? And certainly it's not improving their counts by definition if they're stable. And then I would usually encourage such patients to probably discontinue azacitidine, especially if there's an interesting clinical trial for which they may be eligible. So here's a very interesting and provocative study from our group, if I may say so myself, from my colleague Amer Zeidan here at Yale. And this was a look at the impact of azanucleosides in the real world, if you will. So the SEER Medicare is a database that links the NIH SEER Cancer Registry with Medicare claims. And Dr. Zeidan and his team looked at the outcome of patients in the SEER Medicare database treated with azacitidine or decitabine and did a very careful survival analysis to the extent that's possible within essentially a retrospective large data observational study. And first of all, you can see that although we have no survival data, which is positive in any of the randomized decitabine trials, in this real-world population, you can see that the survival of patients treated with AZA and decitabine are essentially overlapping. You can also see that the median survival of patients treated with these AZA nucleosides is unfortunately inferior to that which was published in the AZA-001 survival study of azacitidine. So disappointing. I think it's still probably better than the control group in the AZA-001 study. And that's not to say that I'm down on azanucleosides. I think they're certainly critically important, and particularly for those patients who get the positive impact in their hemogram. But as with many of our therapies, unfortunately, the performance in an unselected real-world population is inferior to that which is achieved in a careful, controlled, prospective clinical trial. Now we come to the question of who should get iron chelation therapy. And I'm sure people have very strong opinions about this, and we'll probably get lots of letters to the editor disagreeing with me. But the bottom line is, and you can't argue with this, is that we don't really know based on controlled data. But I think many of us believe that chelation is reasonable to consider in patients who've had a lifetime exposure to at least of 20 units of transfused red cells and who are in an ongoing transfusion program, and usually whose serum ferritins exceed 1,000, again, with an ongoing transfusion requirement. Dr. Zeidan led another study in the Medicare population where patients who met these criteria, they had an MDS, they had a lifetime exposure to at least 20 units of red cells, and were still getting transfused, and looked at patients who either got deferrocyrox or who did not, and did the best job they could in controlling for a variety of factors which might go into physician selection of such patients. In other words, you always worry that the patients who were selected for deferrocyrox were patients who were expected to live longer anyway. And given all the difficulties with large data sets and retrospective analysis, Dr. Zeidan did a very rigorous job of attempting to control for all that they could. And you can see in the top curve, looking at survival of patients chosen to get deferrocyrox or not, there was a survival benefit. More importantly, in this very complicated multivariate model, it was shown that for patients who had a cumulative deferrocyrox exposure of greater than 13 weeks, for every subsequent week of deferrocyrox, there was in fact survival benefit, as you can see in the forest plot. And so this analysis has made me pretty much a believer that patients in an ongoing transfusion program who meet these criteria should be offered deferrocyrox. So what about treatment-emergent adverse events for oral chelation therapy? Well, we worry about renal dysfunction and diarrhea. In particular, that's the things that I think make it most difficult for patients to tolerate these drugs. Again, it's my experience that the Jade New preparation is better tolerated than the dissolving X-Jade original formulation. So to conclude, I'd like to leave you with a few takeaway points. We know that myelodysplastic syndrome is a group of diseases in which the median age is older, so these are diseases of the elderly. And most clinical trials have been performed in appropriate age brackets, and thus the reported adverse events really do apply. That's why I haven't mentioned any adverse events in this talk that aren't really what you'd see in the package label. But we do emphasize, or what I'd like to emphasize, is that the tolerance of the adverse events really should be proportionate to the treatment goals. In other words, if we're trying to get somebody to stem cell transplant, we're going to push the azanucleoside farther, tolerate a few admissions potentially for neutropenic infection. However, if we're really sticking to just palliative goals, we may not want to do that. Again, if we're talking about lenalidomide in a non-DEL5Q where it's strictly palliative and we don't have great expectations that it's going to work, I'm not going to let the platelet count drop that far. I just don't think it's worth the risk. I do think emerging data, for example, combining lenalidomide with an ESA is going to continue to improve our mitigation of some of the side effects. I think there's going to be emerging data coming out with Ultrombopag to potentially mitigate some of the side effects, and I think this may make a difference for some of our patients. Thank you for viewing this activity.